The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
We'll be leaving very soon, and if France or some other country wants to get oil or gas, they'll go up through the strait, and almost straight. They'll go right up there, and they'll be able to fend for themselves. I think it'll be very safe, actually, but we have nothing to do with that. What happens to the strait, we're not going to have anything to do with, because these countries, China will go up, and they'll fuel up their beautiful ships, and they'll leave, and they'll take care of themselves. There's no reason for us to do it. It doesn't matter whether they come or not. We've set them back. It'll take 15 to 20 years for them to rebuild what we've done to them. They have no Navy. They have no military. They have no Air Force. They have no telecommunications. They have no anti-aircraft systems. They have no leaders. You know, their leaders are all gone. That's why we have regime change. We have nice new leaders.
So there it is, President Trump announcing that we have regime change already in Iran. We have nice new leaders. Apparently the old leaders are gone, all of them dead. And the new leaders are there and they're ready to move forward with the United States. Seems like it was a whole lot easier than anyone anticipated. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily. I'm Brent Nachtigall. I'm filling in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry. I'm recording this on April 1st, just after lunch. Tomorrow is the first day of Unleavened Bread. So this is when you'll be listening to this or watching this. And Passover was last night, the night to be much observed. Announcing the start of the first day of Unleavened Bread starts tonight. And the members of God's church are excited for these holy days to begin. But we definitely have a program for you today to keep you updated of what's going on. I typically talk about the Middle East when I come on the program and fill in a few times in the year. And that's what I'm going to do for the majority of today's program. So in just looking at what's happened over the past month of this war, I can see that, and it has seemed that Iran has been absolutely obliterated in many ways. Its military infrastructure, they're even targeting a lot of the manufacturing Israel and the United States. And yet we know the biblical prophecy says that Iran is going to stay as a provocateur in on the world stage. And so how effective is the United States and Israel's war going to be? For many pundits, many of the ones that I listen to, they basically said that the best idea, the best way forward is basically go and destroy the place as much as you can of the regime and then walk away. And it will put them back 15 or 20 years and hope for the best. But regime change is something that is just, it's going to be very difficult to even to happen. And so when President Trump comes out and says, we've decapitated most of them, most of the leaders, and yet the new leaders, they are, quote, what did he say there? Their new leaders are nice new leaders, then we have something that we can work with. Well, I don't think you believe that that's going to be the case. This is a regime that has been in power for 47 years, and this is a people, the regime itself, who have been thoroughly indoctrinated with the belief in their the justification for their regime, for the Iranian revolution. It's not done until it takes over the whole world, and it hasn't taken over the whole world yet. It used to be said that the Iranians would use Arabs to go and fight their wars for them, use proxies, they still do that, and that they would keep on fighting to the last Arab, because of course they're Persian, Azeri, and others. And yet, the Iranian regime, we know, would fight until the last Iranian. They would just keep on going. They're not going to bend a knee. So we'll see what happens. President Trump's meant to come out with another statement today and later on. This is a tweet that he just gave just before we're recording this. He said, Iran's new regime president much less radicalized and far more intelligent than his predecessors, has just asked the United States of America for a ceasefire. We will consider when Hormuz Strait is open, free, and clear. Until then, we're blasting Iran into oblivion, or as they say, back to the Stone Age, President DJT. So it is so hard to read into any of these statements. The Iranians say no such thing has happened. They came out after and said nothing has happened. Apparently, there's a new president, according to Mr. Trump, and it's someone that they're willing to work with. Again, I think the pressure is on President Trump. The pressure is affecting the United States economy, world economies. Others are pressuring him. And so he's done his damage, and he's going to try to find a way out. Now, if we didn't have the understanding of biblical prophecy, then it would be completely confusing, I think, what's going on. But biblical prophecy shows us, in the end, what will be the status of the Middle East. Iran will be still there. They'll still be radicalized. They will still have enough firepower and means to provoke a mighty response from the Europeans, not the Israelis or President Trump. They're not going to be the ones that actually, in the end, are the ones that confront the Iranians with full force and put a stop to it, put an end to it. That'll be the Europeans. So we know that that is going to happen. But what is interesting to me is seeing that we have technically a weaker Iran, and yet look what a weaker Iran can still do. It's incredible what they're doing. They've got, at this point, they've still got some ballistic missiles. Passover just started. First day of unleavened bread for the Passover for the Jews just started. And they've rained more ballistic missiles in barrages coming down on Israel today in one barrage than they have since day one of the war. So they're still able to do it. The Houthis are involved now. They weren't involved 4 days ago. Hezbollah is still firing at Israel. So they've still got the firepower. And that's not even including the big problem for the world, that is the closure of the Strait of Hormuz. And yet Iran has, what they've been able to get, with just making it difficult for ships to transit the Strait of Hormuz, for insurance companies to not want to ensure vessels going through there because they might get attacked by the Iranians. Just by closing that, look what chaos they've caused across the world. We'll get into some of that today. But they have so many more tools at their disposal to push at Europe, to push at the US, to push at the Israelis. I mean, the Houthis, these are the ones that control the Bab el-Mandab Strait. We're going to get into this. They only got used, tapped by the Iranians 1 month into the war. And so for everyone that saw the firepower of the US and Israel taking out this, that, and the other thing in Iran, and then with a thinking brain, they were like, well, hang on a second. Iran's not even using the Houthis yet. They could up the ante quite a lot, but they're not even choosing to do that yet. The Iranians could mobilize the Iraqis, the Shiite militias there. There's 100,000 soldiers that answer to Iran as part of the Iraqi security state. They have largely been absent. They have done some rocket attacks on American bases. They could start pushing on Jordan. They could start pushing on Syria. They could start pushing on the Kurds in the north. They haven't even done that yet. There's just so much that they could do. And yet, I think the regime still thinks that they're sitting pretty, and they're learning. They're learning what it takes for all of their infrastructure, all of their goals and ideas to have a nuclear weapon. What we're seeing is, well, all they need is some attack boats, some ballistic missiles, and let's shut down the Strait of Hormuz and watch the world reel. And they've got more assets, as I said, that they can employ. We'll see how this plays out. I did stumble across on my research for the program the Twitter feed of, or the X feed of, the Speaker of the Iranian Parliament. So he is somebody that is still in quite a position of power, and it's very interesting to consider what they are putting out. We've said from the start of this war that one of the greatest assets that the Iranians have is that the American public doesn't have a large stomach for war, And they could look at the tea leaves on the right and see how much chatter was going on amongst MAGA that President Trump was being pushed into this war by Israel. This is all in the months leading up to the war. And so look at what the president of Iran is putting out. Here is the first tweet. We're going to go through these three of these. This is from March 31st, his most recent tweet. And he is retweeting a CNN story. And this is what he says. I just read about Sarah and others in the United States skipping meals because gas prices keep climbing. Sad, but this is what happens when your leaders put others ahead of hardworking and ordinary Americans. It's not America first anymore. It's Israel first. Now, this is just so interesting to me. 2 months ago, they were shouting death to America, death to Israel. Now they're like, America first, everyone. We want America first. We don't want Israel first. That's what's going on with this war. They're just playing into the narrative that's being trumpeted out by the Tuckerites and others, the growing podcasters that are out there that are trying to say that Israel pushed President Trump into this war. That was tweet number one. Next tweet, another one. Palm Sunday masses were held yesterday in Tehran, Tabriz, and Urmia, despite Israel's brutal bombings of civilians. So this tweet is actually retweeting or quoting a tweet that was posted by America First. They're a Twitter handle with 500,000 followers. March 29th, they tweeted that the Israeli police prevented the Latin Patriarch of Jerusalem, Cardinal Pizzaballa, the head of the Catholic Church in the Holy Land, from entering the Church of the Holy Sepulchre to celebrate Palm Sunday Mass. This is the first time in centuries that the heads of the church were barred from celebrating Palm Sunday Mass at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. So the big, and Mr. Livingston talked about this, the big push from this American First quadrant is to try and mobilize Catholic support, traditional Christianity support for this rogue America First movement headed by Tucker and things like that, people like that, and is saying that Israel is actually persecuting Christians inside Israel. And look what they've done now. They've actually barred the patriarch from entering the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. This hasn't been done for hundreds of years and hundreds of years. And then the Iranians jump in and say, we're allowing mass. We're allowing it to take place, but not that bad Israel. And it's just like fodder. It's fodder for the crazies on the right to just, again, look at what Israel's doing. If any of these people have lived in Israel for any length of time, and they would see the freedoms that Christians have. And it's interesting, this is again going back to the tweet from the speaker. He says, before 1948, Christians made up 12.5% of the population in occupied territory, now only 1%. Zionism is trying to erase every trace of Islam and Christianity. If that were true, Israel would just do it. Israel's not trying to do it. There, you go to Nazareth. It's Christian and it's Arab. It's in Israel proper. I mean, they have full custody of this area. Hundreds of thousands of them that are there in Israeli territory. Now, the places there you don't find Christians anymore are places underneath the Palestinian Authority. In fact, places like Bethlehem, you would think that have a lot of Christians. And indeed, they did. Now that percentage, I forget what it is, it's way, 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 way down because of Palestinian Arab control. So this is a lie. Of course, Israel did actually close off for a time the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, as they did Al-Aqsa, as they did the Western Wall. Everyone, why? Because missiles had hit the old city in Jerusalem. That hit, I don't know what it'd be, 400 meters, something like that, from the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. You had debris landing on the roof of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. And as 2 or 3 million Israelis just did right now, as they're trying to celebrate their Passover, they have to run to the safe houses. And so there's a ban on more than 50 people getting together anywhere in Israel in a confined space, just in case a missile would hit them. And so that would affect everything. But apparently the Church of the Holy Sepulchre has their own rules. And so to even put down this fire Prime Minister Netanyahu came out and said, okay, we'll let the patriarch in. Let's not cause an unnecessary dust up. And then the foreign ministry had to put out this clip as well. This is clip one.
Here we are in the old city of Jerusalem. At the Western Wall, fellow of you know it as the Wailing Wall. Empty. Empty because it's under attack from the Iranians. The holy places of Jerusalem, the Wailing Wall, just behind there, also the mosque, and up the road from here, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Unfortunately, all empty, under attack from the Iranians. We're protecting the holy sites, and we're protecting the people who want to pray in the holy sites. As we approach a few days from now, Easter, I just wanted to send a message to all of our Christian friends out there, Church of the Holy Sepulchre, just up the road. Happy Easter, everyone.
And so they have to put that out because the world thinks that Israel, of all nations, the democracy in the Middle East that does tolerate more religious freedom than any other country in the Middle East, the only population where you have a only country where you have a growing Jewish population in the whole Middle East as well, let's put it that way, they have to put out that message to try and show that, well, we were just doing it for all of everybody. Everybody. And yet that's what is America First would latch onto, and that's what the Iranian foreign ministry latches onto as well. And one more tweet and then we'll move on. This is from the day earlier. And of course, there's the No Kings protests that are happening all over the world. This one's crazy. Welcome to the party we started 47 years ago. No Kings. This is the people of Iran and we approve this message. Hashtag No Kings. It's crazy. Like, okay, the Shah was booted 47 years ago. And then they had this democratic, pseudo-democratic, communist-socialist takeover of the Ayatollah. And now they are a democracy. And they have elections every how many years it is. And then we democratically elect our president. And so we're for democracy. We're just like you. We don't like, no kings. Just like you. You guys on the far right, the Tuckerites, we're with you. Israel is pushing America into this war. Israel is shutting down the Christian holy sites. And then on the far left, no kings protesters, we're with you as well. We've actually, 47 years ago, we had to oust our king, and we are total democracy right now. Right. That's not that. If you go into any of the politics of Iran, you understand that anyone that actually reaches the ballot for the president of Iran has gone through religious vetting. They are sworn loyalists to the regime. They are sworn loyalists to the Ayatollah. And so you might not have a king, but you've got a theocratic dictator, basically a king plus. He's both religious and religious head. And he's the one that has the final decision-making power. Now, at the very start of the Islamic Revolution, this was probably outlawed, but they gave into it. And the fact that you have a son that's coming forward to be the one that's going to continue the Islamic regime, the tenets of some of the Islamic regime at its founding are actually being washed away because it shouldn't be heredity, that position. Anyhow, it's just so interesting to me that you have the speaker of the Iranians that is putting out messages for an American audience that hates the war with Iran, and people are just gobbling it up as they go. So I've also noticed something else happened over the past couple of days. More and more allies and or international players have come out against what President Trump has done and kind of separating themselves, basically saying things are going to get tough in our countries and it's all Trump's fault. That's what's going on here. This is Keir Starmer, the Prime Minister of the UK, from today.
The conflict in the Middle East has now entered a second month. And while we're working at pace for de-escalation and peace, it is now clear that the impact of this war will affect the future of our country. So today I want to reassure the British people that no matter how fierce this storm, we are well placed to weather it, and that we have a long-term plan to emerge from it a stronger, a more secure nation. First, Let me say once again, this is not our war. We will not be drawn into the conflict. That is not in our national interest. And the most effective way we can support the cost of living in Britain is to push for de-escalation in the Middle East and a reopening of the Strait of Hormuz, which is such a vital route for energy. To that end, we're exploring each and every diplomatic avenue that is available to us.
It's just amazing to me how fast Britain has fallen from courageous world leader. And what would they do anyway? Like if Iran decides to keep it closed, we've talked about how many limited resources the Navy has in the UK. But he's, and they couldn't do anything to open it anyway, really. They're lacking will, and it's about to hit them, the effect of the Strait of Hormuz being closed. And so he's bracing everyone for it, and he's going to say, well, again, we did not start this war. This is not our war. We're not sending soldiers for it. Again, this is Trump's fault. Now, Australia, the Australian Prime Minister, he came out, Albanese, and he had a statement today as well, because there is some big effects taking place in Australia. They're all the way, they're belonging to the Asian arena. And so when you talk about lack of oil, lack of diesel, lack of fossil fuels, even though Australia is a net exporter of a lot of these things, an exporter of energy, it's struggling right now, and it is going to struggle going forward. Look at what the Prime Minister Albanese had to say about this today as well.
My fellow Australians, by nature, we're an optimistic country, but I understand that right now it's hard to be positive. The war in the Middle East has caused the biggest spike in petrol and diesel prices in history. Australia is not an active participant in this war, but all Australians are paying higher prices because of it. I know that you're seeing this at the servo and at the supermarket, and I understand farmers and truckies, small businesses and families are doing it tough. And the reality is, the economic shocks caused by this war will be with us for months.
A couple of things there. I'm Australian. I don't recall when this happened, but the Prime Minister using these servo, that's a service station for all you guys, the gas station, truckies, they're truck drivers. I mean, it's just interesting the slang that works its way all the way into a serious statement from the Prime Minister. And he's basically saying, we didn't cause this war, but you are all paying for it. It's America's fault, Trump's fault. Trump caused this war, Israel caused this war, and you're all gonna pay for it. Now, it's interesting, just a day earlier, yesterday, the Maritime Union of Australia came out with this statement regarding the crisis that is affecting Australia right now regarding its fuel. It says this, fuel crisis caused by just-in-time supply chains and deliberate offshoring of refineries and shipping. So it's not actually, the effect of what's going on in Australia is caused less by the shortening of oil because of Trump and more of Australia's boneheaded, knuckleheaded decisions in the past. And this is what it gets on going through. This is the Maritime Union of Australia. Australia is staring down a fuel security crisis of its own making, and the federal government must act now to rebuild our sovereign capacity before global conflict leaves the country stranded. For more than a decade, the Maritime Union of Australia has warned that Australia's petroleum supply chain is dangerously exposed. Today, those warnings are becoming reality. Australia now imports more than 90% of its refined fuel entirely on foreign-owned and foreign-crewed vessels. The war with Iran has shown how little control or influence our government has over when fuel shipments arrive, where they go, or who gets priority. That's crazy to me. Australia now imports 90% of all the fuel that it needs, and it doesn't have its own ships to come and bring it down there. It doesn't really have much leverage on others. You could say natural gas a little bit, but they're all getting it from suppliers in Asia. It continues, despite being a major energy exporter, Australia is uniquely vulnerable to diesel and petrol supply shocks. The deliberate closure of Australian oil refineries over a period of almost 15 years has hollowed out domestic production capacity, leaving just two facilities supplying less than 20% of our needs. At the same time, our national fuel reserves fall well short of the 90-day benchmark that's recommended. This is not just an economic issue, it's a national security risk. Multiple fuel shipments to Australia have already been cancelled as foreign governments and corporations move to secure supply for their own populations first. Across Asia, export restrictions and domestic prioritization are tightening access to refined fuels, while ongoing instability in key global shipping routes continues to disrupt supply chains. So it's just interesting. Australia could have done far more refining itself, and they would have had some petrol and diesel, more of it to use. They could have stored more. But this is what happens when you've got a shortfall. It happened with toilet paper in Australia more than anywhere else. We hear there's a shortening of toilet paper, so we're going to all go out and buy some. So that's what everyone in Asia is doing. Everyone that Australia buys their diesel and fuels, refined fuels off. There's not necessarily a major shortfall yet, but they're hoarding it for themselves. And they're saying, we're not giving it to you guys. We're keeping it for ourselves. And Australia, what are they going to do? What are they going to do? They don't even have the vessels to bring it down here. It continues. Australia is being, just a couple minutes on this, Australia is being forced to compete on the open market for fuel cargoes, often at higher costs with no guarantee of delivery. At the same time, there is no Australian-controlled tanker fleet to step in. A decade ago, Australian flagged and crewed vessels ensured fuel could be safely and reliably transported around our coastline. Today, that capability has been completely dismantled. Instead, multinational shipping cartels and oil companies determine whether Australia's fuel needs are met, with no obligation to prioritize this country or protect consumers from price shocks. Our ability to move fuel to where it is needed, whether for industry, transport, agriculture, or emergency response, is now dependent on decisions made offshore, not by Australians. And they say, time to rebuild Australia's fuel sovereignty now. So for all of the Prime Minister of Australia blaming the war in the Middle East, and sure, that's the initial reason that's caused the upset, talk about it, just some horrible governance to trade off, to stop refining the fuel yourself and to not have the ships that you can control to bring the oil or bring the fuel into Australia. It's sad. It's really sad to see. And there is a price that's being paid down in Australia. I forget what it is. I've got Australia, a family that lives in Western Australia, lives in Brisbane. And of course, there's going to be knock-on effects that are happening because of higher fuel prices already. As noticed at the servo, as said by Mr. Albanese. And the Asian nations are already, they're rationing as well. Indonesia, they just started introducing emergency energy saving measures starting today as well, rationing fuel. Their private vehicle purchases are now capped at 50 liters per day. Government employees are told you need to work remotely on Fridays to reduce fuel and energy consumption as well. So these are real life effects that are taking place in Asia. They might not be feeling them too much in America. America's fuel has gone up a little bit. That's mainly because you have American companies that want to buy into this thought that, hey, there's higher energy, there's higher oil prices coming out of the Middle East. So that means higher oil prices for our own domestic production. Not really. Everyone just wants to make a buck. And then the fuel stations, they want to make a buck as well. So everyone's making a buck on the thought that fuel should be more expensive. There has never been a greater divergence in the price of crude from one part of the world to another. Price of oil that is produced in the United States, it doesn't have to go up that much. What happened? What changed? Well, they just realized they can get more money for it. This is capitalism. This is capitalism at its core. And so now you're seeing some of the difficulties of it. Capitalism might be better than socialism, but it has its weakness. and that is unchecked greed. And you can see that in place in the United States. But the effect on Europe is what we're watching for most in terms of biblical prophecy. This makes sense because we know that Europe is the one that's going to be provoked to coming down with ships and sorting out Iran. This is released today. This is an article from Reuters. International Energy Agency warns Middle East oil disruptions to hit Europe in April. That's today. Oil supplies disruption from the Middle East will rise in April and begin to impact Europe's economy at the closure of the Strait of Hormuz as the closure of the Strait of Hormuz severely curbs supplies, International Energy Agency head Fatih Birol says. Talks about 12 million barrels have been lost since the start of the war. He says, quote, the loss of oil in April will be twice the loss in March on top of the loss of liquefied natural gas. It will come through inflation, will cut economic growth in many countries. The article continues, the biggest problem is the lack of jet fuel and diesel, which has already affected Asian countries, but was also due to hit Europe. Quote, we are seeing that in Asia, but soon, I think, in April or May, it would come to Europe as well. And so headed for a major disruption, the biggest in history up until now. And it hasn't even got that bad yet. Can you please play clip 4? This is about the Bab el-Mandeb Strait.
Iran is effectively blocking one of the most important shipping routes in the world, the Strait of Hormuz. Approximately 20% of global daily oil supplies pass through this narrow waterway located between Iran and Oman. The oil comes mostly from countries in the region, including Iraq, Kuwait, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and Iran. So what's the alternative? And are any of the options viable? There are two critical oil pipelines that bypass the Strait of Hormuz. The first is the East-West pipeline that runs 1,200 kilometers across Saudi Arabia, from the Abqaiq oil field in the Gulf to Yanbu on the Red Sea. The Saudi oil giant Aramco is moving to push flows towards its 7 million barrel a day capacity, but that doesn't compare to the nearly 20 million barrels that usually pass through the Strait of Hormuz each day. The second is the Habshan-Fujairah pipeline that runs 360 kilometers from the Habshan onshore field in Abu Dhabi to the port of Fujairah on the Gulf of Oman. However, this option is even more limited. It only has a capacity of 1.5 million barrels a day with a potential increase of up to 1.8 million. But that's still more than 90% less than the amount that passes through the Strait of Hormuz. There are two other pipelines that could be of importance. The Kirkuk-Ceyhan runs 970 kilometers, connecting Iraq's northern oil fields to the Turkish Mediterranean port of Ceyhan. It also has a capacity of nearly 1.5 million barrels a day, although it's now largely dormant because of regional tensions and disputes over production. And finally, the Gorajask pipeline, which was specifically built by Iran to bypass the Strait of Hormuz. Before the war, its operation capacity was estimated to be around 300,000 barrels a day, which is significantly lower than its designed capacity of 1 million. It's also faced huge challenges, partly because of strict US sanctions targeting Iran's oil industry.
So what you can see from that, I just wanted to give a bit of an explainer about some of the options that do exist, because we're focused all right now on the Strait of Hormuz and that being largely closed. But you could see that there are pipelines that exist to get oil to not have to go around the Strait of Hormuz on ships. The East-West pipeline, this is the one that transits Saudi Arabia, and it goes all the way across Saudi Arabia to the Red Sea, bypasses the Bab el-Mandeb Strait. That's at the Gate of Tears at the southern end of the Red Sea where the Houthis are, which we'll talk about in a second. And this pipeline, it's hard to hit because it's largely underground. Of course, it has an exit point and an entrance point as well that could be hit. And before the war, it was not fully functional, but now, as of March 28, it is fully functional, meaning that it's running at maximum transit of oil. 7 million barrels per day are going to across Saudi Arabia and hitting the Red Sea, or at least getting to there. 5 million barrels of that is available to export. And then part of that is going to refineries on the Red Sea, and some of that is available to export as well. So pretty interesting that this has just been arced up to the point that it's running at maximum capacity. And you can get all the way into Europe using oil. You don't actually have to take a European ship or a ship that's destined for oil and go around the Strait of Hormuz. If Saudi Arabia is willing to sell it to European nations, they can just go. That's a great map there. Thanks for putting that up, Jesse. If you just go down, you can see where Yanbu is. This is where the pipeline goes through. Europe can access its oil there, and others, and it can sail through the Suez Canal and back up into Europe if necessary. But this is just interesting to me because this pipeline's been in existence for over a decade now. It wasn't ultimately necessary, but it did help the Saudis sell a lot of their oil, get it to market. But now it's becoming more and more important. And so you can see why the Saudis would like Iran to be finished. They still have access point for their oil. A lot of their oil is still being able to get out to market. But what happens then if the Houthis start to play? Because what is interesting is the Houthis were out of this war for a long time. They didn't fight for a month. And then they decided that now is a good time. And it just so happens that it correlates to the time period that maximum output was coming through this pipeline into the Red Sea. Let's have a look at what the Houthis can do. This is just a short that was done on YouTube. I forget who I need to give for credit, but perhaps there it's up on the clip.
نفذت قواتنا المسلحة بعون الله تعالى وبالتوكل عليه العملية العسكرية الثالثة في معركة الجهاد المقدس والتي استهدفت بدفعة من الصواريخ البالستية أهدافا حساسة للعدو الإسرائيلي جنوبي فلسطين المحتلة وقد جاءت العملية بالاشتراك مع الإخوة المجاهدين في إيران وحزب الله في لبنان وحققت بفضل الله أهدافها بنجاح تؤكد القوات المسلحة اليمنية أن توجه العدو نحو تصعيد عدوانه وجرائمه واعتداءاته على لبنان وإيران والعراق وفلسطين لن يدفع اليمن الحر الأبي إلا للمزيد من التصعيد خلال الفترة المقبلة حتى وقف العدوان ورفع الحصار.
Apologize to you if you were listening to that. I should have given you a little bit more of a ready, set, go on the Arabic that was going to come through. That's the Houthi spokesperson basically saying that from now on, we are in this war. We just did a joint attack with Hezbollah and the Iranians. The Iranians have fired ballistic missiles. We're firing ballistic missiles. This just happened overnight. And Hezbollah from the north are firing. So for everyone that thinks that the Iranians have just been decimated with their proxies, I mean, you've still got a three-front war that are firing at the Israelis at the same time. That's incredible. Now, why are they doing it against the Israelis right now? Again, this goes back to, I think, showing the world what the Houthis are capable of. The Israelis is an easy target, as we'll get to, for them. There is an impact there on Israeli society, for sure. But the Iranians are showing that if they want to, they can also disrupt oil transiting the Red Sea. If you can go back to clip 4, we'll play that one now.
Do you know there's a second Hormuz that can choke global trade overnight? It's the Bab al-Mandab Strait, just 30 kilometers wide at its narrowest point, that links the Indian Ocean to the Red Sea and the Suez Canal. Around 10 to 12% of global trade and nearly 4 million barrels of oil per day pass through this corridor. Look at its strategic location. On one side is Yemen, where Iran-backed Houthi forces have already warned of shutting this route. On the other side is Djibouti, hosting US, Chinese, and French military bases monitoring every move. movement. Now, zoom out. Iran already controls traffic through the Strait of Hormuz. If Bab al-Mandab is disrupted too, two of the world's key energy routes come under pressure at the same time. And this isn't new. In 1973, during the Yom Kippur War, Arab forces blocked the strait for weeks, stopping oil shipments and cutting off Israel's Red Sea access. Just imagine, if the strait is blocked today, a ship would take 10 to 14 more days to reach Europe.
So it just gives you another idea of a card that Iran has yet to play. You have the oil transiting through the Bab al-Mandab, which is a lot less now because it's not coming through the Strait of Hormuz. But then you also have the ability of the Houthis to target Yanbu, this port city that is also being where oil is coming from Saudi Arabia to the middle part of the Red Sea. Now, this is also interesting in terms of biblical prophecy. Iran might tap this. They might start doing this if they feel like they need more to up the ante with President Trump. President Trump seemed more and more willing to cut a deal when the Houthis start to be activated. But right now, there's a deal with the United States. The United States won't hit the Houthis if the Houthis don't disrupt shipping through the Strait of Hormuz. And so they're going to strike at Israel. Israel's an easy target, but it's a warning. It's a warning to the United States. It's a warning to others that, hey, the Strait of Hormuz might be opened up, but then we're going to target the Bab al-Mandab. Now, this is actually something the Asians might want. The Asians might want that because their oil will be able to get out of the Strait of Hormuz. But Europe would be impacted. The Bab al-Mandab is mainly about oil going to Europe. And so this could be a play that they make even with a deal with President Trump. We'll see how it goes. If you want to know more about this, about the Red Sea strategy of Iran and how important it is for their push at Europe, you definitely need to read King of the South by Mr. Gerald Flory. It goes into the forecast of what is happening with Iran, how they're going to push at Europe to push them to have a forceful response. I know this book is oftentimes referenced. If you haven't read it, you want to make sense, and you need to, because I mean, every second day there's a new statement. Like, well, which way is it going to go? I don't know. God has drawn attention to the Middle East, and particularly to what Iran is doing in the Middle East, as a sign of where we all are, everyone is on planet Earth in terms of biblical prophecy, end time events. It's one of those highly visible dominoes that falls as we progress towards the return of Jesus Christ. And so to understand what's going on, even to anticipate things and know how close we are to these events, it's important that you're able to prove this to yourself. You can watch news stories. It's what I do. I look at news stories. How do they fit inside the framework of end time events? And this book just does a great job at showing that. It also shows the last 30, 40 years of accurate forecasting regarding this as well. So definitely get that book and order it. Go to thetrumpet.com and you can order it there if you haven't already. I do want to just move over to one other area that is not getting too much of attention of the Middle East. And this is what's taking place in Lebanon. Israel is going into southern Lebanon with force. For the past couple of weeks, they've been blowing up bridges in southern Lebanon to prevent Hezbollah fighters from making their way further south, this cutting off the supply lines of Hezbollah. Hezbollah, of course, they are the proxy of Iran. I just read, before I went on the show, 5 minutes before, a message from the new Ayatollah to the head of Hezbollah, thanking him for joining the war, joining this fight. And Hezbollah is firing salvo upon salvo into northern Israel, central Israel, 60, 80 rockets, missiles a day. You probably haven't heard about that. And for this reason, Israel has gone in. And they're going in because this is what they said they were going to do. There was a ceasefire after the October 7th war with Hezbollah. And it was basically said, okay, we'll stop firing if Hezbollah removes itself from this area in southern Lebanon called, well, the area south of the Litani River. Hezbollah decided not to do that. Hezbollah decided they would stay there. The Lebanese army was meant to move them out. The Lebanese army didn't do it. They largely didn't have the power to do it. UN peacekeepers were there. They were meant to oversee the removal of these forces. They didn't do it. And so when Hezbollah decides they're going to fire rockets and join this war against Israel, Israel is like, thank you very much. This is what we've been waiting for. Now we're going to actually do what we had planned to do from the very beginning, because we don't trust anyone else with our security. We are going to go and remove Hezbollah fighters from southern Lebanon. So for the past week and a half, Israel has been moving into southern Lebanon, creating a buffer zone to remove Hezbollah forces from the border of Israel so they cannot perpetrate a October 7th in the north of Israel. This is one of the war goals that was started over 2 years ago. And I think what's interesting about that, most people forget this, it was very clear from day two, October 8th, that Israel was going to have to do this. And so no one in Israel is surprised that they're doing this. Everyone outside of Israel looks like they are surprised. And they think this is just Israel invading a neighbor because they want to, when that obviously isn't the case. Here is how The Guardian Australia is reporting this. This is clip 7.
איראן היא לא אותה איראן, חיזבאללה הוא לא אותו חיזבאללה, וחמאס הוא לא אותו חמאס. אלה כבר לא צבאות טרור שמאיימים על הקיום שלנו, אלה אויבים מוקים שנלחמים על הקיום שלהם. ובלבנון הנחיתי עכשיו להרחיב עוד יותר את רצועת הביטחון הקיימת, כדי לסכל סופית את איום הפלישה, וכדי להרחיק מגבולנו את ירי טילי הנוטט. אבל עדיין יש לחיזבאללה יכולת שיורית לשגר רקטות אלינו. אנחנו נחושים, אנחנו נלחמים, ובעזרת השם, אנחנו מנצחים.
So that obviously wasn't The Guardian. That was my fault calling out the wrong clip. That was Prime Minister Netanyahu announcing to the world that they are going to create a buffer zone in Lebanon. They're sick of Lebanese soldiers being right there. Hezbollah soldiers being right there, being able to fire anti-tank missiles across the border and hitting farmers in northern Israel. I mean, it's so obvious that this shouldn't be allowed. A lot of the Lebanese are actually on side with this. There are about 1 million Lebanese out of 5 million that are currently displaced because Israel is routing Hezbollah from their country. The Lebanese just decided that they wanted, this was a week ago, that they wanted the Iranian foreign minister, the Iranian ambassador, to be booted out of their country because they're sick of the Iranians making their country into a place of war through Hezbollah. And the Iranians just said, not going to do it, not going to move. Looks like Israel might have just taken him out today. And honestly, there are a lot of people in Lebanon that understand what Israel is doing. I've never seen more response from Lebanese people I follow that they are wanting Hezbollah to be removed and are backing a lot of what Israel is doing. Now, it's very hard. It's very hard to get that narrative into Lebanon or be able to promulgate that narrative openly still, because there is a lot of support or substantial support still for Hezbollah. So we'll see how this plays out. But we do have Israel that are going to be pushing into Lebanon, and they are not going to cease their operation until Hezbollah has been removed. Hezbollah right now is cut off from Iran. Iran doesn't have the money, doesn't have the finance, doesn't have the land bridge across Syria to reach them anymore. You even had the Syrian government, the Jolani's government, the former al-Qaeda guy that now rules Syria, who hates Iran as well, him actually putting his forces on the border of Lebanon to ensure that nobody was getting into Lebanon that Hezbollah fighters weren't trying to get out for a time and come back in. They're actually helping for a time as well. And so going forward, what we can see in Lebanon is something we've talked about for a long time, that Hezbollah is going to be removed from Lebanon. Now, being an observer here in the United States or living in Israel, it's very easy to say something like that. It's very hard for the people on the ground. Hezbollah has made itself into a charity. It looks after people. It's got pension funds. It looks after the Shiites, runs schools. And so this is a big deal to say that, oh, Hezbollah is going to leave. I mean, these are Lebanese, many of them. They're not just Iranian fighters coming into Lebanon. They exist there, but they are Lebanese citizens as well. And so when we say that Hezbollah will be removed from Lebanon, this is something we say with weight as well, because it does take a lot of, it is going to hurt the state. But it does seem like there is public opinion for it. Now, again, why is this important? If you read the King of the South booklet, you know the Bible prophecy showed us that Lebanon was not going to be controlled by Iran. Once Syria fell, all the land bridge across Iraq, which Iraq does, Iranians do control Iraq. Once the land bridge of Syria fell, there was no way of resupplying Hezbollah. It was only a matter of time, and Israel knows this. And so now they're working, I would say, not together hand in hand with the Lebanese, some in the Lebanese government, but definitely they're going to put out statements that Israel is aggressive and things like that. But there's more and more statements coming out that it's Hezbollah's turn to leave, just like the Syrians left 20 years ago. They're sick of being a battleground for Iran's proxy wars. And Bible prophecy said that was going to happen. Even when Hezbollah was so strong in Lebanon, that controlled the government in Lebanon, that's what Mr. Gerald Flory wrote in the King of the South booklet, because that's what the Bible said. And it's happening. It's happening right now. And because Iran can't get access to the Mediterranean Sea that way, well, that's why they're strengthening their hold along the Red Sea passageway, controlling the oil choke points of the Strait of Hormuz and the Bab el-Mandeb. I mean, we could have seen this coming a long time ago. But look at what the Iranians can do with some attack boats, some missiles. They can hold world oil to ransom, the world to ransom on its oil. Now, there's one final thing that we should be watching for right now, and that is what's happening in Egypt. Because it is very difficult for Iran to completely shut down oil to Europe if that pipeline is functional across Saudi Arabia, unloading at Yanbu, and then the ships can sail down from Europe through the Suez Canal, pick up the oil and refined products, and go back up to Europe. So biblical prophecy actually indicates that Iran is going to ally with Egypt. It's going to go one step further than it has already. And that'll give it actual control of the Suez Canal as well. Perhaps they learn from this. Perhaps they learn that we have the Strait of Hormuz, we have the Bab el-Mandeb, but unless we have the Suez Canal as well, then it's impossible for us to totally shut down oil to Europe. And so this is something definitely that we need to be watching for. This is again, written on in the King of the South booklet. Just want to go to one scripture here, passage of scripture that details all of this. This is found in Daniel chapter 11 and verse 40, and I'll read it through. This is the basis for our understanding of what Iran is doing right now, controlling the oil choke points all through the Red Sea passageway from the Strait of Hormuz, and provoking Europe, making Europe, and even Trump's saying that. France, you want to come deal with it, you come down and deal with it. We're out of here. We don't need the oil. You want the oil? You come get it. You deal with the Iranians. And this is exactly what the Bible prophecy says is eventually going to happen. This is Daniel 11 and verse 40. It says, "And at the time of the end shall the king of the south," that is radical Islam led by the Iranian regime, it's not going anywhere. You might have a different leader. It's not going anywhere. Look at Gaza. Hamas is still in control. Hamas have not given up their weapons, and the place is leveled. So you could level Iran, and it's still going to maintain the tenets of the revolution. It's still going to push. They will push at him, and the king of the north, that is a German-led Europe, will come against him like a whirlwind with chariots, with horsemen, many ships. He's going to come down to this region with his ships. Shall enter into the countries and overflow and pass over. He shall enter into the glorious land as well, the land of Israel. And many countries shall be overthrown. And then go down to verse 42. And he shall stretch out his hand also upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. He has to take over Egypt. King of the North has to take over Egypt. Why? Because the Iranians have taken over. And this is if you wanted a prophecy that is bold. This is it. Iranian takeover of Egypt. I mean, one's the Shiite powerhouse and the other a Sunni. And most of the time, the Shiites and the Sunnis, Egypt and Sunni, have fought against each other for 1,000 years. And you're to tell me that the Iranian regime is actually going to get strong enough inside Egypt to dominate it and control the Suez Canal? That defies logic. Well, it's not logic necessarily we're working with here. Of course, there is a logic to it. We know they're both radical Islamists, and the infidel is worse than the other Islamist. But this is, I'm mentioning this so that when it happens, you can realize how bold this forecast is based on the Bible. It says here in verse 43, he shall have power over the treasures of gold and of silver and over all the precious things of Egypt, and the Libyans and the Ethiopians shall not escape. The king of the north is going to have to take over the Libya, Ethiopia as well, southern Mediterranean. Ethiopia here all pushes, this is right down where the Bab el-Mandab is. This is the Red Sea passageway, land of Egypt to the land of where the Ethiopia is. This is what Iran is going to control. And it is going to make Europe finally respond. It won't be the United States at this point. It won't even be the Israelis. But when you see European ships respond to Iran, you know that we're close to this being fulfilled. And again, it's one of those major dominoes that happens on a very tight schedule before the second coming of Jesus Christ. That's why we watch the Middle East. That's why we watch oil flow out of the Strait of Hormuz. That's why we watch Iran's takeover of part of Yemen, controlling of these vital sea passageway, these vital sea gates, because it has everything to do with biblical prophecy and what's going to take place here right before the coming of the Messiah. Thank you very much for being with me today. I really appreciate that. If you'd like to send some feedback, you can write your emails to td@thetrumpet.com. And I think someone will be back with you live tomorrow. Have a good day.